Hey guys, this is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their job and their process. My producer is Lou Pellegrino, and today's guest is the ESPN college basketball analyst, Seth Greenberg. You see him on College Game Day. We're taping this in March, so you will see him on all sorts of shows on that network throughout this month and early April. As part of many things in this podcast, I asked Seth Greenberg how he prepares for covering the NCAA tournament regarding knowing pretty cold the 68 teams that are in the tournament.
To me, it's not about today. It's not about last week. It's about July, August, September, October, November. I'm a basketball fan. I'm a basketball junkie. My dad played for Claire B at LIU. My brother played in college basketball, worked for the Trailblazers, was GM of the Knicks. This is who we are. This is our family business.
We'll talk about how forthcoming programs are or are not, whether coaches should do in-game and pre-game and post-game interviews. Clearly, Seth and I are in agreement on that. I'll ask Seth about getting mistaken often on Twitter for Seth Davis. We'll talk briefly about Steph Curry and much more. I think you're going to enjoy, especially if you're a college basketball fan. Here's our conversation with Seth Greenberg, the ESPN college basketball analyst. All right, and we head out to somewhere in beautiful Connecticut to bring in ESPN college basketball analyst Seth Greenberg. Seth, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Seth, before we start, I will just let the audience know just how horrible my voice feels and sounds, so I apologize in advance for hurting your ears. Let's hope that Seth is entertaining enough where he will overcome my horrible voice today. So the pressure's on you, Seth. It's like the NCAA tournament.
I put up with Billis every day. Your voice could be no more piercing than his.
Nice, nice. All right. First off, this is obviously the month that is the most meaningful when it comes to your job. I realize you're on for the college basketball season, but this is when the attention of the country is on college basketball. So let's say from like March, March 10th or so to April 10th, and go as long as you want on this. What do your ESPN bosses tell you about your responsibilities and expectations for this month?
The one thing about ESPN, they give you a platform. I'm not sure that they give you an expectation. The expectation is they put you on the air. You should be entertaining. You should be informative. You should be opinionated. But you should also do it within your own personality. Don't be opinionated to have an opinion. Be an opinionated because you have a strong feeling about something. So I think one of the great things to me since joining ESPN is that they let me be me. To me, I lived in the world of coaching. I did it for 36 years. And, what I do, and as opposed to what people on Twitter or on that listen and watch us do, is I'm a fan of basketball, but I'm not a fan of any one team. And all I do is I say what I see and I speak from my heart using my 36 years of coaching, basically as from my experiences, what I see and what I think about a team. So they don't coach you up. They just kind of let you be who you are. And I guess if they put you on, they think you're pretty good at it.
Seth, one of the interesting things, no matter how you feel about Dick Vitale's style, one of the interesting things that I think he got very early on, and he got this from the people who hired him and maybe just sort of his own intrinsic kind of feel for television, is that there's a lot of entertainment in terms of the job of studio sports analyst or game sports analyst. So on top of the preparation, how much do you feel like you have to be an entertainer? Where's that line between informing and entertaining, if there is a line or if it just all combines?
I think it's combined, Richard. I think, to me, if you can't have fun with it, this is sport. This is college basketball. This is the NCAA tournament. This is Duke or Carolina or Michigan State, Michigan or UCLA, Arizona. I mean, if you can't put your arms around that and have fun and be passionate about it, you shouldn't be talking about it. And to me, yeah, it is part entertainment. I mean, if a person's going to turn on the television, they want to be informed, they want to be educated, and they want to be entertained. And I don't go about saying, well, I'm going to say something funny. I think if you have to try to be entertaining, I think the message doesn't come across, and it comes across fake. I think things happen, and in the manner in which you present things, they create the entertainment. I think the biggest thing is being passionate. I mean, Coach Vitale, 77 years old, he brings the same passion each and every day to his broadcast. And to me, people feed off of that. Coach Vitale recruited my brother, Brad, when he was an assistant coach at Rutgers. And he's the same guy today that he was when he was an assistant coach at Rutgers, except he left Lorraine in the car when he came to do the home visit. And my mom said, "There's a woman in your car. Who's that?" He goes, "That's just my wife. Don't worry about it." And obviously, we brought her into the house for the home visit. But to me, what makes Coach special is that he has the same passion, the same energy, the same enthusiasm, and people can feel that. You can't fake that enthusiasm. Either you have it or you don't. Either you're passionate about the game or you don't. Whether you're passionate about the people that play the game and everything that surrounds the game, and you know that enthusiasm comes across, and I think part of that becomes entertainment.
Seth, there are 68 teams in the NCAA tournament if you count the first four teams. You're around the sport obviously for the year, so that you are watching games, I would imagine, consistently, and even through reading and osmosis, you're going to learn about stuff. But you know, there's an expectation in your position to really know these 68 teams. So go as long as you want in terms of how do you prepare for the start of the NCAA tournament in being able to speak rather fluidly on all these potential teams. Not the, all these potential teams that can win, but all the teams that potentially could be in the tournament.
It doesn't start. It starts to me in the summer. I mean, like, if you don't live it, I approach this job no different than I coach coaching. And to me, a big part of coaching is preparation. And if you're starting to prepare right now, then you know what? You're not going to be able to prepare adequately. I spend the whole summer, like I do, I spend the summer going to events, seeing the young players, so I know who's coming up. I spend the summer talking to coaches to get a feel for their team. I spend the summer going around watching guys work out. I spend the whole preseason. I probably did 20 different practices this preseason. You know, Synergy is a great tool for me that I can watch film on teams. I do an incredible amount of reading. My whole deal is if you're preparing for the tournament right now, today, you can talk about what happened in a game as it happens, but you can't forecast what's going to happen in a game without doing your preparation. So to me, it's not about today. It's not about last week. It's about July, August, September, October, November. I'm a basketball fan. I'm a basketball junkie. My dad played for Claire B at LIU. My brother played in college basketball, worked for the Trailblazers, was GM of the Knicks. This is who we are. This is our family business, is basketball, and college basketball specifically. You know, the guy I work with, Jay Will, who I love, who's like a son or a brother to me, all right, he's 34 years old. He might be on Entertainment Tonight in 5 years, for all I know. You know, to me, I know one thing. You know, I'm passionate about one thing when it comes to professionally. I'm passionate about basketball, and that's basically my focus 12 months a year, almost 7 days a week. It's my addiction. It's something that I can't remember a time I wasn't passionate about learning about the games, the teams, and, you know, from my coaching background, it's just one of those things that I enjoy doing. It's not a job. It's not work. It's something I really, truly enjoy.
I didn't know about that Claire B connection. That's really interesting. I want to talk to you about, you mentioned talking to coaches. And this will be a multi-part question. First off, how forthcoming do you think coaches are with you compared to someone who is not a former coach?
Oh, it's night and day. It's night and day. But you understand, the guys I'm talking to, a lot of them, I grew up in this profession with, not this profession, but my coaching profession. We have so many shared experiences together. I competed against those guys recruiting. I competed against those guys on the floor. You know, without mentioning names, I mentor probably 20 or 30 guys right now. I'm a guy that's a sounding board. If I wanted to be a quote-unquote insider, I could be the all-time greatest insider. But that's not my role. I'm an analyst. And I don't say it precociously. It's just that, I mean, these guys call me and we talk about their teams. They want another set of eyes on their teams, or if something happens during the course of a game, or if their teams are struggling. I get as many calls like that that I make out to guys just to in doing my homework. But I have a different relationship. They don't, I'm a basketball coach that works in the media. And it's different. And I think that my peers, my old peers, still perceive me as someone who's walked in their shoes. So, and again, nothing against anyone else. And I don't look at myself as a journalist because I think it would be an insult to a real journalist. And it doesn't stop me from having an opinion. In fact, I say things. I'll give you a perfect example. Like, I have John Calipari is a dear friend.
Right. And I remember I was going to get to you should have had a little Twitter interaction with a story Pat Forty wrote. I remember that not too long ago.
Yeah, I had that. We'll get to that later. But like, John Calipari's team wasn't playing very well this year. All right. They weren't guarding anymore. They weren't connected. I had no problem going on TV and said their defensive effort was pathetic. And that when I think of Cal's teams, I think of teams that are committed defensively. All right, I get a phone call from him later on. He goes, "I agree with you." I say things that I would hope a coach could play to their team and say, "You know what? You've been hearing this from me for the last 2 weeks. Here's a guy that's watching our team play. It's the exact same thing." So all I do is to speak the truth. If I tell the truth and I'm honest. That's all that counts to me. I mean, I'm not going to, I don't pick favoritism. I don't have an agenda. My agenda is to be honest and say what I see through the prism that I looked at for 36 years.
All right. Let me ask you a question. That's very interesting stuff, Seth, because I'm going to put my cynic hat on for a second, or skeptic sure. hat. Maybe it's a little bit better. So I appreciate you saying you mentor guys, you have relationships with coaches. One of my, and I don't say this pejoratively, I just, when I write about media, I am trying to be honest with viewers. I don't particularly ever believe an analyst is telling you everything that they know about programs and coaches, particularly if they were former coaches. So that's a preamble to say, as a viewer, how forthcoming are you with me regarding what you really know about certain teams, players, and coaches?
I'm as forthcoming as probably anyone in our business. Because I don't, as long as I feel from my heart of hearts, it's the truth, I have no problem saying it. Now, I also understand, Richard, how difficult it is. You could come into the timeout, you could have drilled that special situation 30 times in practice, you could call a timeout, review the set, go out on the floor, and you know what? A kid could kick it away. It can happen. And, the easiest thing is, what do they do? What do they do in practice? In the end, when the light goes on, the X's and O's, and it's an old phrase, or Janes and Joes, certain things you have no control over. But the things I say, like, here's a perfect example. People say, "Oh, Seth Greenberg, he hates Duke." No, I don't. In fact, to me, when I went to Virginia Tech, my whole goal was for our team to play as hard as those Duke teams because their huddles were tighter, their self-talk was better. They drew a line in the sand every single play. The respect I had for their program, how they did it, and what they did was immense. Now, that doesn't mean if Grayson Allen does something wrong, it's not my responsibility to say, you know what, I don't think that's right. From my prism, from my years of experience, I don't care if Coach K is a Hall of Fame coach. I don't care if he's an Olympic coach. To me, all right, I don't feel in my heart of hearts, nothing against him personally, I don't think that's right. Or if, something happens in a game and a team is not competing, or a guy is taking bad shots, or maybe we've said it before, sometimes I don't understand Roy Williams. Why wouldn't he call a timeout to end a run? Well, that's not his philosophy. I respect his philosophy. I don't have to agree with his philosophy. I'll say that. And as long as I'm speaking truthfully and from the prism I look at the game from, that's my opinion from my years of experience. Now, you could say, well, hey, you only won 400 games or whatever. You know, that's why you're in media. And that's fine. You want to say that, that's fine. But I'm going to say what I feel in my heart of hearts from my experience, from what I see. And the coaches that I've, quote-unquote, been supportive of or not been supportive of, I'd say 99% of them have appreciated my honesty.
Seth, I want to expand this into when it becomes when there are issues off the court. And I'm not asking you, Seth Greenberg, in terms of your opinion, but I would like to get a sense from you, from someone who's now in the business and from someone who's watched a lot of former coaches who are now in the business. On the whole, do you believe college basketball analysts are critical enough of coaches and programs when it comes to things that happen off the court, from the worst of the worst, like something like at Baylor football, to some mild violation that happened at a program?
I can't speak for the masses. For example, the Baylor football thing, it's repulsive. I cannot believe anyone could not be very critical of how that was handled, and the whole situation to me is numbing to me. And I think that, to me, you've just got to be, Richard, you just got to be, I can't speak for someone else. You got to be true to yourself. Don't have an opinion to have an opinion. Don't take a shot at someone to take a shot at someone. But if something happens, I would hope, coach or not coach, host or coach or analyst to insider who thinks they're an analyst or whatever role anyone plays, you should have an opinion, and you should be honest in that opinion and be consistent with that opinion. And I think a good majority of our people are like that, but some people don't want to get outside of themselves. Some people don't want to offend. Some people don't want to take an opinion, take an adverse opinion, because they're going to have to be dealing with those coaches. I don't think you should take unfair shots. I think every story has two sides, and that's probably my biggest problem. I think when people tell only one side of the story, I think that's wrong. But when it comes to an opinion on an event, why do you put, you know, a microphone on if something happens and you're not going to have an opinion? And like I say, it doesn't have to be right. It's your opinion. It's not a fact. You can't state your opinion like it's a fact. It's your opinion. It's what you think in that moment in time from the information that you gathered. I would hope that most of our people would be honest in that situation.
Seth, what is your proudest moment on ESPN's airwaves so far?
My proudest moment at ESPN?
Yeah, or the moment where you think that this sort of represented the apex of what you want to bring to viewers?
Man, that's a great question. The proudest moment, I think there's a couple things. I wouldn't say proud, but the times I take people inside what it's like to be on the bubble, and I always joke about it, and I'm self-deprecating about it, being on the bubble for 48 straight months.
Right.
But being honest about what that experience is about, I think that's something that's unique. I think the times that Jay Will loves when I do this, when he asks me to give a talk I would give to a team in that moment in time for that specific game, because I am actually getting those people behind, inside the ropes, if you might add, because I try not to hold back. I don't know if it's a proud moment, but, you know, I guess when all of the Grayson Allen stuff came up, it pained me to see that kid look like he's in the pain. I know I've got a lot of grief about it, but I wasn't afraid to say how I felt as a parent. And, you know, my words were probably a little misinterpreted, and I didn't do a very good job on my Twitter when I said that I think he needs to step away. And I said for the year, that was probably a little extreme, but I meant step away to kind of look in the mirror and make sure that he's okay. But I don't know if there's any one proud moment. I mean, look, I'm very, very fortunate. Here's a big thing, Richard. I don't take for granted the opportunity I've been given. I don't take for granted the job I have. I approach what I do with the same passion that I did when I coached. I understand how fortunate I am, and I understand I have a job to do, and I might not say what you want to hear, but I'm going to say what I feel in my heart of hearts and what I really believe in, and I'm not going to make stuff up. So every day I tell the truth from my looking at something through my eyes and my prism, I'm proud of that.
Seth, whether it's a college game day or doing a SportsCenter hit or working on a podcast, is there any assignment at ESPN that you particularly like more than another, and if so, why?
Game day is fun, and I think that this year especially, we were a little bit more conversation-driven, and I wouldn't say debate or discussion-driven, which I think is really good, because Jay Will looks at it through one prism, I look at it through one prism, Jay Billis looks at it through one prism, and you got the greatest point guard in the world in Reese Davis, who kind of ties the whole thing together. I enjoy doing when I can shape my own SportsCenter hit, and I can show what, why, and how something happens, or what, why something is going to happen, because I pull all my own video, so that I can basically bring someone inside and give them a better insight into a specific game. I really enjoy that. It's probably the closest thing I get to coaching. And it's, if done right with the touchscreen, it's fun and it's enjoyable and hopefully informative. So doing those SportsCenter hits where I can teach a little bit and entertain, I think that's, I enjoy that a great deal. But the discussions and the conversations that we have in game day, the discussions that Jay Will and I have on the set when we have fills, like I love fills. Like the producers hate them because it's a grind. The hosts hate them because it's sometimes a grind. But it's easy for me and Jay, because all we do is we talk about either the game, a league, what's happening in that moment in time in our sport, and we get to do it for an extended period of time. The wraps are the hardest, and I know they're very important, but they're the hardest because you have such a small opportunity and a small window to make your point. You've got to get in, get out, do it in as few words as possible, and that's probably the most difficult, and it's something that I'm working on. But I work with the greatest people in the world. I mean, I understand your job, but the producers that we work with are incredible. The hosts we work with are incredible. You have everyone pulling in the same direction, and all they want to do is help. You never question if everyone is on the same page. So I think, whatever I do, I'm so fortunate, because the one thing is that everyone is on the same page. And, the people I work with, from, obviously Jay and RD, to the great, the producers that are patient and have helped me kind of hopefully grow in this job, I can't be more appreciative of them.
Who are the producers you've most worked with?
Rob Lemley, who does our Monday and Tuesday nights and raps. Rob is just, he's terrific, and he's fun. He makes it fun. I mean, Aaron Katzman, who did our game day this year, they're just snarky enough in your ear to, almost make you chuckle at times, and they're not afraid to give you a little grief, but they give you the freedom, and they give you good feedback. What Lee Fitting's been able to do, overseeing college sports, but helping give me a better insight into what I do, how I do it. I mean, we really just work with really good people. Barry Sachs, who's no longer at ESPN, was probably the first person that brought me around and showed me, all right, now this is how you're going to break down a touchscreen, or, you want to kind of lead into it, forecast what you're going to show. It's just, I'm a basketball coach that's working in the media, that obviously has an opinion, is not afraid to talk, but it's what you say, how you say it, learning how to disagree without being disagreeable with the person you're working with, getting your point across in a point where someone has time to get their point across back so you can have the give and take, the debate, the conversation, the discussion to make it interesting. All those people taught me how to do that better, and that's why I'm part of a great team. And that's why I say every time I do something like this, I don't take for granted this opportunity, because there are a lot of fired coaches, and not all of them get the opportunity and the platform that I've been given to do what I love to do, and that's, you know, if I can't coach, to talk about basketball.
Seth, how competitive is it for former coaches or players at ESPN regarding getting airtime?
I think it's competitive. I would be remiss in saying, hey, look, we all know the shows that are being promoted. You can tell by watching the ads that they run, you know, what shows they're pushing. And, you know, you want to get on the shows that have the eyes. We all know the difference in ESPN, ESPN2. We all know the difference of Monday night to Thursday night to game day, or, you know, for the guys that do more games than I do, we know which are the biggest games. It's competitive. I would hope it's respectful. Look, everyone has egos. Coaches have egos. People in the broadcasting industry have egos. We all want to be on the best games or the biggest shows. And, you always wonder, well, I'm not on that show. What does that mean? It's human nature. I guess if you didn't want, you're putting it together, if players and coaches, you're putting together a group of competitive people. We all think we're good. We all think that, I can do that. But we also all have a pretty good platform. But it's competitive. There's no doubt about it. It's competitive. But there's a good camaraderie within, at least I can only speak for basketball, within the basketball family. I speak to all these guys all the time. I mean, I go on Dan Dalkin's show every single week. And we solve two fired coaches solving the world's and college basketball's problems. Usually a fascinating 30 minutes. And we're undefeated for 5 years, so our opinions mean everything. But it's competitive, but I think in a good way. Does that make sense?
It does. This is interesting to me. You were a successful college basketball coach. I have your head coaching record here, 383 wins, 293 losses. That's winning games at a 57% clip. You're two-time ACC Coach of the Year. You won Big West championships. As many people know you mostly from Virginia Tech, but you were at Long Beach State and South Florida. So this is a good career. This is where I'm buttering you up for a second.
I appreciate that.
Now,
you're stroking me here.
Right, so here comes the hammer. Do you worry at all down the road about a big-time coach coming in and taking your spot, merely not because they're better as a broadcaster, but because they would have such a big name that it would be hard for ESPN's bosses not to bring someone in like that?
Yeah, worry about it? Sure you do. I mean, I think anyone worries about their, to me, this is my career now. And, I was brought in and someone else was let go. I understand that. Look, you work at ESPN. I mean, some of, the people that laid the mortar of that building are no longer there. Leadership has changed. The person that oversees college basketball has changed. Do I understand that? Yeah, you understand it. I almost wonder, will they bring the next 50-something guy in now that I'm 61? Huh. 3-4 years down the line, am I still going to be viable? Am I still going to be relevant? That's why I work so hard. That's why I never say no. That's why I do all my homework in June, July, August, September, October to make myself more valuable. That's why I do a podcast. Could my role change at some time? It could. It could. Do I worry about my brand? I'm too old to worry about my brand. I'm a 60-year-old basketball coach talking about ball. I mean, I guess that's my brand. My good friend Barry Sachs says, don't worry about your brand. Your brand is fine. You are successful. You're fun. You're entertaining. Do what you do. But, yeah, I mean, it's not just in sports broadcasting, though, Richard, is it? It's in every walk of life.
Right, for sure.
I mean, every CEO, every you know, manager, every person in any walk of life, you know, you're probably looking over your shoulder a little bit when you get, you know, to be my age. Do I think I'm good? I think I'm good. I don't know if anyone else thinks I'm good. Do I think I have strong opinions? Yep. Do I think I'm prepared? Yep. Can anyone do what I do? Yeah, probably anyone could do it. Could they do it as well as I could do? I don't know. I'm not a media a guy that does that. So could it happen? Sure, it could happen. And if it happens, will there still be a role for me at ESPN? I would hope there would be. Would there be a role for me somewhere else? I would think there would be. So, you know, you can't worry about it. I mean, every job has its downfalls. I'm not dealing with alumni. I'm not dealing with raising money. I'm not dealing with the decisions of 18-year-olds. I'm not dealing with, you know, trying to sign players that might, you know, recruit for 2 years and then, you know, someone comes in late. And because that school sounds better, you might not get that kid. So, look, there's no perfect world. There's no Shangri-La. You put your head down. You work as hard as you can. You're a good teammate. You think you bring value, but it could happen. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not, my head's not in the stand. I've been fired before now.
In terms of, I'll scratch that for a second. I read a profile of you in the Washington Post. I don't remember the date, but I think it was probably 2012 or something to that effect, or 2013. And the story had you selling your Blacksburg home and moving to Avon, Connecticut, which is fairly close to Bristol. This is before you signed a contract with the network. So I just want to clarify this, because this is kind of fascinating, potentially. Did you move to Connecticut without some kind of handshake deal to ESPN, just on the sheer hope that you can convince them to get a job, or were you pretty solid that they were going to offer you something when you moved?
No, I mean, I hadn't signed the papers and, you know, the documents. I was in the midst of still finalizing my settlement with ESPN, with Virginia Tech. So I hadn't signed my papers, but, you know, I have representation. I never had a coaching agent.
Wow.
I had a guy that just did my contract. It was really stupid, to be honest with you. I never had a coaching agent. So, I mean, I had to have some attorneys when I got let go, make sure that I got what they owed me. So until that was resolved, I wasn't going to sign my contract with ESPN, but I had an agreement with ESPN.
Gotcha.
And to me, the whole move to Connecticut, which obviously has ended up a good move, Richard, was I can't have one foot in and one foot out in anything I do. You know, you get all of me, or you get none of me in a lot of ways. You know, if I was going to do this, and I was going to see if this was going to be my next career, I had to have both feet in. I couldn't be flying in, you know, on Monday and Tuesday and Saturday. I wanted to not only be part of the culture, I wanted to feel the culture. I wanted to better immerse myself in what it took to be successful in this new profession. And so the commitment, and then I had a daughter who was a senior in high school, going to be a senior in high school. And I wanted to share her senior year with her. You got to understand, my two older daughters went to Virginia Tech. Coaching was our family business. You know, my oldest daughter played volleyball for a year, but I mean, she went to every road game with me her senior year. My middle daughter was a cheerleader. The famous game with Florida State where they took the shot at the buzzer and they didn't count, and I went to stand up and I ended up elbowing her in the head. Was one of the funniest videos ever. But
right.
I mean, she cheered for my game, my biggest games. When our win, when we beat Duke in College Game Day, I mean, that was a shared experience with us. But I had a younger daughter who was going to be a senior in high school. I was the coach of Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech's a town of 24,000 people. I couldn't stay there. That was not an option. We had to move. All right. It wouldn't have been healthy for me. I mean, my middle daughter graduated a semester early, so she didn't have to be on campus during the basketball season. She lost a semester of her college experience when I got let go. See, people don't see all those things. People say, oh, you got paid. You know, they bought you out, and they did this. And that. Yeah, they did it, but they don't see the impact it has on your family, your wife, your children. Basketball was the family business. It was taken away from us. I had to reinvent myself at 55 And the only way I could do that and do justice to it was to pick up and immerse myself in the job, in the culture, with the people, to feel the culture and to experience this the way, in my opinion, I could only do it with both feet in.
Seth, in your experience, both personally as well as any coaches who have asked you about this, how important is it to create relationships with broadcasting producers, broadcasting talent while you are in the game? Because in terms of everything that I've ever reported on and every person I've ever talked to, the very smart people in the business who eventually move from coaching to broadcasting or playing to broadcasting start making those connections as active players and coaches. Now, it gets a little tricky, obviously, in you know, the sort of the journalism part of that if you're the broadcasting group. But is that something you did, or if nothing else, do you see college coaches already trying to make these contacts looking for the broadcasting career down the road?
A little bit of both. Like, first of all, when you have games on TV, you would be foolish not to be accommodating, not to connect, and not to basically be as accessible as humanly possible to the people that are doing your games, because basically it's a two-hour infomercial for your program.
Right.
So whether it's the producer or whether it's the play-by-play or the color guys, was I accommodating? Was I did I open my arms and welcome them into our practices, to our meetings? To would I wear a microphone during a game? Would I let them in my locker room? Yeah, because you know what? I was using that vehicle, whether it was ESPN or whomever, to help promote our program. Yeah, you know, I wasn't Coach K. I wasn't Rick Pitino. I wasn't Roy Williams. I wasn't at North Carolina. We needed those impressions. We needed to brand our program. In terms of the producers and the people that were working our games, without a doubt, did I think in the back of my mind I was going to be working there? No, I didn't. Now, I did do things. I forget how far back, but years back, CBS College Sports, when they first started, literally, when it was family and friends only, they approached me and gave me a one day, asked me to come in one day to do some NCAA tournament stuff. That one day turned into 2 weeks. Gideon Cohen, who was now my agent, who was oversaw talent at CBS College Sports at the time, had a recommendation, I think, from Hank Goldberg or Sid Rosenberg or one of those guys, that this guy Seth Greenberg, South Florida, he's pretty good on his feet, and you know, he knows a lot about college basketball. Well, they brought me in for one day, and at the end of that day, they said, can you come in next Thursday to Saturday and the following Thursday, you know, throughout the tournament? And I said, sure, I'll do it. I'm glad to, because it's a good way to, even though you're not in the tournament, in a lot of ways you're part of the tournament because you're on. Now, little did I know back then, no one was watching CBS College Sports, but I was accessible. I mean, I was accommodating, and I was prepared, and I think I did it. You know, I guess I did all right because they kept on asking me back. And then the same thing happened, and at the end of my last year at Virginia Tech, I had a great recruiting class coming in. I had Montrezl Harrell coming in who won a national championship with Louisville. I had started four freshmen and a sophomore, and I thought I was going to have a great team, but they asked me if I wanted to come in and do some work, and I said sure, and little did I know that was going to be my audition. And I came back, and a week later, while a recruit was on campus, I was called into the athletic director's office and told that not only am I fired, but 15 minutes later, there was a press conference. But that experience of being accessible and being hopefully easy to work with and everything else opened up another career for me. Did I think someday I would do what I'm doing now? At some level, not at the level I'm at now, at some level? Yeah, I probably did. I was a communications major in college. I love this sport. I love talking about it. I love everything around it. Did I think I would be doing it on College game day? That's not probably something that I thought would happen, and it goes back to the same thing. it's been a win-win, hopefully, but more importantly, I don't take it for granted. I'm so, I'm so fortunate to be given this opportunity, and I work every single day to hopefully let those people know that, that they made a good decision.
Do you wonder why other programs or certain programs are not press friendly? Is it a question of they don't have to be if they're that successful? Because it always, so I cover the women's game, and one of the things that I really enjoy and that always strikes me with the women's game is that the top programs, Connecticut's, Notre Dame's, Maryland, South Carolina's, they are as open can be when it comes to press attention. Obviously, some of that has to do with the women's game, isn't the men's game. We all know that. But the philosophy is there, and it's when a guy like Auriemma, with all his wins, lets people in. He wants people to see what they are doing. He wants his players to get that kind of exposure. Why is that not always the case on the men's side with equally successful programs?
Ego. I mean, just be honest with his ego. I mean, like, there are a lot of guys that let you in. I mean, John Calipari will let you in.
He will.
Because he understands the business of the business. He understands that the platform that he's given, and he uses the platform. He's always ahead of the curve. He thinks outside the box, and he, let's face it, in a lot of ways, by being accessible, he uses ESPN or CBS or whomever. And that's who he is. I mean, Tom Izzo gets it. All right. He lets people inside because he understands, you know what? It will help him build his program. There are guys that, they won't get it. Look, I sat in the ACC meetings. I fought for allowing people to do sideline interviews, some of the stuff that I'm doing now for ESPN. I fought for, having coaches mic'd up. Because I thought that, Kay and Roy, they don't need it. But you know what? At that moment in time when I was coaching, Brad Brownell and Coach Donahue and myself and, Sidney Lowe and Oliver Purnell, you know what? We needed it. Because we needed to, let's face it, people talk about ESPN. ESPN college basketball. Yeah, it's Kentucky. It's Duke. It's North Carolina. It is, but all the rest of us get on too now. And when we did get on, and with these crazy TV contracts and games on Monday, Tuesday, Sunday, Thursday, man, you needed to use that to build your program. Duke and Carolina and some other programs don't have to do that. But I think in a big picture, the smart guys use it. And let's face it, in the next 5 years, Duke's going to need to do it. Carolina's going to need to do it. Miami's going to need to do it. Louisville's going to need to do it. Syracuse is going to need to do it because when those five guys leave, the guys that come in aren't going to have the established brand that those guys have.
Right. That's
so you're going to see a change in how people approach television and being accommodating, I think, drastically when things change. Like, how hard is it to talk to a guy and answer one question? They hold the game up, boom, answer question. How hard is it that as you're walking off the court, all right, you can do it in the NCAA tournament. Why can't you do it during an ESPN broadcast in February? You're walking off the court. Hey, coach, they changed defense at the end. What adjustment are you going to make? Sometimes you don't even have to say anything. A Cal never answers a question.
Right.
He's hilarious. He says whatever's on his mind. Tom Izzo will answer the question. I mean, other guys will be great, but I don't think some guys just don't think they need it. Their egos get in the way of the good of the group.
I'm with you on that. It's absurd. It's also, I feel like, a responsibility to the public. Do you feel the same way
about the amount of money that they're getting paid?
Yeah, of course. Do you feel the same way about the mid-game interview, which, again, coaches who get mad at that just seems ridiculous, but you're a former coach. Maybe there's a distinction for you there.
The in-game interviews, they can, like I brought it up, well, they do it in the NBA. Well, that's different. No, it's not different. It's not different. People say, why am I doing that? I mean, the in-game interviews, here's the deal about that. The in-game interviews, guys will do it for me, and this upsets real journalists and real media, because the relationships and because they know I know exactly what not to ask. And they know that if a game's going sideways, I'll give you a perfect example. We did Michigan State, Maryland a year ago. I was supposed to do Tom Izzo coming out of the 16 at second half. And Maryland just went on this run. Melo Trimble came down the lane, foul, and one, going to free throw line. Obviously, the timeout comes. I just tell Jeff Define, I said, Jeff, can't do it, man. Not doing it. Wrong time. I'm going to sit here. Let's see how the next 4 minutes come. Next 4 minutes go. Michigan State played a little better. We get a great moment. I said, Tom, I said, you got things straight now, blah, 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 blah. You know, what's the most important thing you said to your team in that timeout? And he goes, we're going to run this so-and-so play. Let's see how smart I am. And he says, you know, so-and-so is going to be open. All right. Now, someone else probably, if it was at the 16-minute mark, they probably would have forced their way into the 16-minute mark. I respected that moment in time, and then we got something pretty cool out of 12. Now, after the game, he comes up to me and goes, why didn't you come at 16? That would have been good TV. That's what Izzo goes. I said, your team didn't want to see you at 16. Why would I want to talk to you at 16? I don't think, look, coaches should be able to do it. You're finished with the timeout. The way we do it in college as opposed to the NBA, I wait for them to finish their timeout, do everything they have to do with their team. They hold the game for 15 seconds. I ask them one question. How hard is it to answer one question? Seriously. Guys answer questions while they're doing brain surgery.
Yeah, it's not hard. That's the point. And I feel like a lot of coaches have been enabled for years on this. All right, a couple more here, Seth. I don't know if you're contractually allowed to answer this, but I'll ask it anyway. Did you take notice of the fact that I believe I'm correct here? Virginia Tech made the NCAA tournament for the first time since you coached there.
Did I take note of it?
Yes.
Yeah, I took note of it.
Do you have any thoughts on that particular occurrence?
They've got a pretty good team this year. I mean, they survived Clark's injury. They spread it out. They average 11 threes a game. I think they're shooting 56% from the three since Clark went out. I think Zach LaDay is a tough matchup. Contractually, I talk about Virginia Tech and if they become a story. And that's really simple. People say, well, he doesn't talk about Virginia Tech. Well, they became a story this year. They won games. So they win games, then they become a story. They had a heck of a season. They had a really good ACC schedule. They had, I think, one of the weakest schedules in the ACC with the unbalanced schedule. But they won the games they had to win, and they were great in late games. They were absolutely terrific in time and score in late game situations. They play a different style of basketball. It's fast. It's fun. He's fit his system to his personnel. And, I'm not losing, like I said, I mean, my issues with Virginia Tech have nothing to do with the current administration.
Gotcha. All right. One last question and coaching question before we finish up with some broadcasting. You, I imagine now, because of Steph Curry's success, get asked about scholarships and why he didn't play there all the time. I've read your answers.
Man, it took you this long to get to this question? I figured you were going to come right at it.
No.
Shoot, I'm actually proud of you. This is great patience.
You're welcome. and you're actually going to be surprised because my question is not going to necessarily be what you even expect. You had said clearly many times that you scouted him in high school. There wasn't an available scholarship. You did eventually offer him a 4-year scholarship with plans to redshirt him. And he eventually attends Davidson and gets coached by McKillop. And obviously, we know he's gone on to being a great player. I honestly don't necessarily care about Steph Curry. You've answered this question 100 times. My question for you is, how do you feel about should college basketball coaches have to address when they don't recruit a guy who a lot of fans think would be a fit for that program, whether it's family ties or he lived there? And the guy goes elsewhere. That's what I'm more interested in, and just sort of how you philosophically see that question being asked of you. Because the reason people ask it of you is obviously just because of Dell's history there. That's if Dell mm-hmm. Curry went to Nebraska, you're never getting that question. That's just kind of interesting to me in terms of there's a lot of fans who just make the connect that because a guy has a family connection or there's an expectation where he's supposed to play, that means he's supposed to play there.
Yeah, I mean, they have a right to ask it, and they have the right to be disappointed. And look, I was the only ACC coach to do a home visit with the Currys. And and he came and visited campus. And, you know, the real story is what you just said. They have a right, and they have a right to be disappointed. But, you know, in that moment in time, if you don't have a scholarship, you don't have a scholarship. If people knew he was going to be this good, you don't think Duke and Carolina would recruit him?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, this isn't an exact science. Right. I thought he was a really good player. I thought he could score. I thought he could make plays. I also thought, as a freshman, if he came into our place with Xavier Dowdell and Jamon Gordon was the defensive player of the year in the ACC. Xavier Dowdell led us to wins, first team All-ACC, led us to wins over Duke and Carolina at Duke and Carolina. I'm not sure he would have been the guy he is today, because those guys would have beaten the snot out of him every day in practice. Bobby McKillop did a masterful job. Here's my deal. I'm happy for the kid. Bobby McKillop's a dear friend. He's a terrific coach. It was a magical, great run and story. And I'm happy for him. I don't begrudge anyone. I do begrudge maybe the true story never really coming to fruition and being honestly dealt with, but that's neither here nor there. But fans being upset, yeah, I hope they were happy that we recruited Malcolm Delaney, who no one recruited. I hope they were happy that I got Xavier Nadell come from Pahokee, Florida, when his only other scholarship offer was Stetson. I didn't think he was going to be that good either. So, I mean, look, you make mistakes. It's easy to look back. And, you know, I make mistakes every day. I made mistakes all the time. Also made, obviously, enough good decisions to win a couple of ACC coaches a year and to win at Fog Allen Fieldhouse, to win at Cameron Indoor Stadium, to win at Freedom Hall, to win at the Dean Dome, to win at the Comcast Center. I mean, so, hey, it's never as good as you think it is. It's never as bad as you think it is. And, you know, if I knew things for sure, I'd move to Vegas and sit at a parlor and just make myself a bunch of money.
Well, you made a fine decision coming on this podcast, Seth.
no doubt about it.
One last thing about Curry, and it's it's not related to Virginia Tech, but is it still possible in 2017 that a guy could be that great in the NBA who doesn't in high school get recruited by a Duke or North Carolina? Like, is that? I realize we're only talking 10 years ago, or I don't even know how old Steph Curry is. But I'm like,
every year.
Is that possibility still exists where somebody who is like a first team All NBA talent can still get missed by the Big Five, Big Six schools?
Yeah, well, look at Lillard. Look at CJ McCollum.
Yeah. That's true. You're right.
For sure that can happen. I mean, guys make the leagues from the craziest places. I mean,
But it's one thing making the league. It's another thing being a first team All NBA.
Hassan Whiteside.
Yeah, good player. Right. Lillard is good though. That's a good example. I mean, a big time player.
Does it happen a lot? No. There's a certain the one thing is, especially at the guard position. You know, because you can see a kid come out of high school. I mean, you know, Steph was probably 130, 140 pounds.
Jesus.
Real thin, could get it off real quick. Played for his dad and his AU team, which played off the beaten track in terms of, you know, he didn't play for a real shoe company sponsored team in the biggest events. They played, they played in Swanee that year as opposed to the Peach Jam. Now he put up crazy numbers, and think about his pedigree and what his dad did. But I think it can happen. Probably more at the guard position because people take a risk for bigs. But this is an inexact science. Look, recruiting is inexact, drafting is inexact, selecting a coach is inexact because everything is about fit. You know, in the media it's inexact. Like I'm sure there are guys that got jobs that you said, man, how's that going to work? And they've blown up. And then you've probably seen other guys, get promotions or get shows, and you go, that thing's going to be a home run, and it's fallen flat on its face.
Yep. First of all, you're exactly right, because I'll give you one example of a guy who works at ESPN. Lewis Riddick was brought in essentially as a day player by Seth Markman, their NFL studio point person.
He's a stud.
Right. No, absolutely no NFL pedigree, not as famous as Ray Lewis or Joe Montana or anybody like that, and has become one of the best analyst at ESPN. That's a guy that literally came from nowhere in terms of broadcast scouting. So it could definitely happen in broadcasting in the same way you bring a guy off the field. He's one of the most famous people ever in athletics, and it just doesn't work in broadcasting.
Yeah, opportunity. Look, we all have flaws. Every profession is hard. I love when people say, well, that's a really hard job. All jobs are hard, whether it's coaching, whether it's broadcasting. Now, I do think that the job we do, and probably some of my compatriots will cringe, like, we get paid really significant amounts of money to talk about ball.
Right.
We should never complain. We should never complain. One of my pet peeves, when guys start complaining and whining and whatnot, come on, now, seriously? We're talking about ball. We don't win, we don't lose. After the game, we go and eat. We got great gigs.
Yeah, sometimes you can even expense those foods. So, there you go.
How about my first 2 years? I never put in expenses.
Nice.
I came from a state school situation
right,
where I was so paranoid about expense reports. Finally, the Don Wind, who helped me with my expense accounts, said, why don't you ever put in for meals? I said, I don't know. I mean, we get a couple meals. Yeah, everyone puts in for meals. I said, oh, they do? I mean, it's we have a great gig. I mean, I've said it 100 times, but the biggest thing that I've been fortunate to do is given this opportunity and to work with the people I work with. And I know that sounds Pollyanna, but it isn't. It's really from my heart because I had no idea what it was going to be like.
Seth, here are the final two from me. I will ask you who you pick to win it all.
UCLA.
And why is that?
I think the rules are set up for the offense right now in college basketball. The freedom of movement, you can't tag cutters, you can't bump rollers, there's no five-second call, the game is more free-flowing, and they're the best offensive team in college basketball. And I think that in that, just for that reason, they're just so good offensively. And I'll go on my pedestal on one thing. Duke was, I don't know about the S-curve, but if they were on the four line because they lost three of their last four in defending the committee, and because they lost three of their last four, that's why they were on the four line, who would have said they lost three out of four, now all of a sudden they're going to turn it around and play their best basketball of the season in the tournament? Because of that, I totally understand why they're in the two line and not the one line.
All right. You're all right there, Seth? You need to take whatever's going on in your house?
No. My dog just went outside.
We leave all
the Wonder Dog.
We leave all natural sound on, so this is good. We like when that stuff happens. finally, a Twitter question to end this. I'd like to, and this was a couple of people asked on Twitter when I said I was going to have you on. How often do you get mistaken for Seth Davis on Twitter, and how fun is it after Seth Davis drops some political commentary and people yell at you?
It's hilarious. I get a lot of his tweets, and I always say the same thing. I say, I'm the one who talks about basketball. He's the one who's trying to solve the problems of society.
Your handle is Seth on Hoops, correct? And he is
Seth on Hoops.
And he is, I believe, he's just Seth Davis Hoops. So there's the
yes. Yes.
There it is. All right, Seth Greenberg is an ESPN college basketball analyst. You can see his work on a variety of ESPN shows this month, whether it's whenever they're doing essentially their bracketology stuff, or SportsCenter has college basketball analysis. He'll be there. Seth, is there anything specific as well that listeners should look for you on in terms of you will obviously be during Final Four and Championship Weekend.
Well, we've got a 24-hour of brackets coming up.
Right.
We've got game day obviously throughout the weeks,
month of March,
kind of wrapping around the different games, and then we'll be out in Phoenix. And it's a great time of the year. It's a fun time of the year, and I'm excited to be part of it.
Seth, I appreciate you coming on today. I've always thought you've done really interesting work, and you're a good voice for college basketball.
That's very nice to say, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you.
You got it. Thanks very much, Seth.
All right, man.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Seth Greenberg of ESPN. My voice, apologies again for the voice, boy. I'd like to drop a curse here just so Lou can tag the explicit tag on, but I won't. But it's really bleeping bad at the moment. Thank you for listening to previous SI podcasts. The last couple have been Brian Anderson of Turner Sports, Jim Trotter of ESPN, Jamie Little, and Shannon Spake, the Fox broadcasters who do NASCAR, Conrad Thompson, who's got a wrestling dynasty now with his tremendous podcasts, and Ryan Rosillo, Ramona Shelburne. We got some good ones coming up, but I'm going to cut it off here just to rest the voice. My thanks to Lou Pellegrino, my producer as always. Thanks to the people of Digital Media, and thanks to the Sports Illustrated staff who supports these podcasts. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the SI Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.